This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It doesn't take many times for someone to get behind the wheel, whether it's a car or a truck or what vehicle it may be, and head out onto Interstate 80-94 and experience for oneself exactly how difficult it is to drive. And it's that way because of all the traffic and what has to be certainly one of the Midwest's busiest interstate highways. We have the Indiana Department of Transportation very much interested in working up a way to help make it easier to travel and safer to travel on 80-94. Adam Parkhouse is the Communications Director for the NDOT LaPorte District, and he is with us to talk about a series of public meetings, two of them in person this week and one that'll be online next week to talk more about what is called the 80-94 Flex Road Project. Adam, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
What are some of the things that the researchers at NDOT, that they don't already know, have discovered about the need for making some major improvements and finding different ways to travel on I-80-94?
Sure. So it'll come as no surprise to folks who live and work in and around Lake County that what we call the Borman Expressway, I-94, up in that area, is the busiest stretch of road in the state of Indiana. Nothing in Indianapolis surpasses it, anything like that. So all that traffic, including truck traffic coming to and from Chicago, that stretch of road carries a ton of traffic. So as folks who travel there regularly know, as you mentioned, obviously congestion can be an issue at times. So what we're looking at here through what's called a PEL study, it's a planning and environmental linkages study, is what are some options that we can look at, some kind of innovative tactics that we can use through this corridor to ease some of that congestion along the Borman?
I know that researchers all over, not only the Midwest, but around the country, have been looking for ways to help make expressways, very much like 80-94, not only easier to travel, but safer to travel as well. What are some of the ideas that you're asking citizens here in Northwest Indiana to talk about at these series of public meetings that might in turn be incorporated in making some major changes to the Borman Expressway?
Sure. There are several options that would be available to us through what's known as TISMO, T-S-M-O, or Traffic Systems Management and Operations. So there's a number of different possibilities, and that's what we hope the PEL study will sort of reveal. So some of those include what's known as hard shoulder running, where, you know, there is a hard shoulder like on the inside like there is now, only that becomes like an additional lane of travel during peak time, but only during peak time. And you might say, well, how would you keep traffic off of that hard shoulder when you don't want traffic on there during those peak times? So you may, if you traveled to other parts of the country, you may recall on a busy interstate or something, seeing some overhead gantries that have either like green check marks or red X's indicating to drivers what lanes they can be in at any given time. So a system like that is a possibility. There are things like ramp metering, which basically is kind of a cool high-tech way to measure how traffic is coming off of a ramp and merging onto the main line. And when the traffic coming off that ramp is getting too heavy, it would activate a signal, basically stopping traffic there, or basically, you know, trying to more effectively and efficiently merge traffic from that ramp onto the main line. So there's a number of different things that the PEL will look to, and that's exactly what we want to get the public feedback on in these public meetings that you referenced that are coming up this week, and then the virtual option next week.
I understand that NDOT has incorporated some work with an engineering firm called Parsons on this project. In fact, I guess they're the lead agency on this project, working with NDOT on this. What has the folks at Parsons done so far in getting things set up for public meetings coming up on the 80-94 Flex Road project?
Sure. The folks at Parsons are our consultant on this PEL study for us, and they've been just tremendous to work with. And I want to direct folks, your listeners, to a website that our friends at Parsons have created called IndianaFlexRoad.com. That's IndianaFlexRoad.com. Flex Road is the branding that we've assigned to this project. So Flex Road, less stop, more go is sort of the tagline. And that really, I think, And it's got a nice little logo and things like that. So there's some great information on that website, IndianaFlexRoad.com. But we really think that tagline, "Less stop, more go," really encompasses what we're trying to accomplish here, which is when you're traveling on the Bourne, when you're traveling on 94, whether you're going to or from Chicago, and of course our partners at IDOT in Illinois are involved in these discussions too, as obviously we're very connected in this endeavor. We can't promise that you'll never have to stop. We're just trying to make it so that you stop a little bit less often, and you're able to, go ahead.
That would be a big help in itself when you think about it. And yeah. we should mention too that even though NDOT is really taking the lead on this, because most of the worst of 80-94 is in Indiana, in Lake County in particular. There are other stretches, in the stretch in Illinois, but we're talking about in particular, I guess, going to the west from the state line to Illinois 394. So it's just there are all kinds of ways that that Indiana and Illinois can cooperate in trying to make travel a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a great partnership with our partners over at IDOT, and they've been at the table in discussions on this as well. And this stretch of the Bourne on the Indiana side, at least on an average day, we'll see around 190,000 vehicles, and on a busy day it can be more like 250,000. And that's to put that into perspective, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's a lot of traffic, no matter how many lanes you have. And and again, anybody that's driven around Indianapolis on 65 or 465, there's a lot of traffic down there, and not even those roads approach the numbers that we see on the Bourne. So it's a busy stretch of road, and we're just looking for innovative ways to try to tackle it. And that's certainly what we hope this process will help us determine. And I mentioned that this is part of a Pell study. And what a Pell study is in general, it's a multi-year kind of thing, a long-term sort of study. But what it is hyper-focused on public involvement. And that's really what we want here is we want to hear from the stakeholders, the people who use the Bourne to get to and from school or work or vacation, leisure, wherever they might be going, and see what they think about some of these various options and whether or not they think they'll work. And we're genuinely interested and need that feedback from the public.
If you will, Adam, would tell us about the two public in-person meetings that are coming up this week and about the one online meeting coming up next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thanks, Chris, for the opportunity to help us spread the word about these. Because again, we really, really do want and need that public input on this project. So there are two in-person public meetings this week, as you mentioned, one on Wednesday, one on Thursday. Both are at 5:00. The one on Wednesday is at 21st Century Charter School in Gary. That's 556 Washington Street over there in Gary. Mm-hmm. And then on Thursday, the 29th at 5:00, it's at Alumni Hall on the Purdue Northwest campus in Hammond. That's 2233 173rd Street in Hammond. So those are two opportunities for members of the public to come, listen to a presentation, and then offer feedback on what they hear and what they see. And then we'll have a virtual option for those who might be more inclined to want to participate virtually via WebEx on Tuesday, August 3rd, and that'll start at 6:00. There is a link to register in advance for that virtual public meeting on IndianaFlexRoad.com.
Now, I know that the concern, of course, of traveling on 80-94 a lot of times is dealing with all of the congestion, vehicles of all types, trucks, cars, all sorts of vehicles, but also it's safety as well, too. I guess we think about there are wrecks that happen on 80-94. I guess we're lucky they don't happen as often as they could, but it's still, I know, something that NDOT is very concerned about. What's been some of the data that you all have put out about some of the crashes that have happened over, like, in the last couple of years? I know of between 2017 and 2019 were the last two study years. What did NDOT find out about the number of crashes that have happened on 80-94?
Sure. Listen, there's two things that drive everything we do here at NDOT, safety and mobility. And safety is a huge part of, and really in most cases, the number one concern that we're looking at to try to make our road network safer. As I mentioned, up to 250,000 vehicles a day can travel this stretch of road. And with that sort of volume comes crashes. And what we want to do is try to make that try to look, you can't eliminate crashes, right? Mm-hmm. But our goal is always to reduce them and minimize them as much as we possibly can. And we think by increasing mobility, that's why I've said safety and mobility, because they really go hand in hand. When people are asked to stop unexpectedly on a high-speed interstate because there's a backup or there's a traffic jam or something like that, that can inherently lead to a safety risk. So we really genuinely believe by increasing mobility, and we see this bear out throughout our entire road network, when you increase mobility, you hand-in-hand goes, you increase safety. So it's obviously a very important part of this. We're calling it Less Stop, More Go, which certainly indicates mobility, but this is all with safety in mind as well.
Now, how long will this take for this Pell study to be done so that you can move along and get more work done and following through on the 8094 Flex Road project itself?
Sure. So currently, we'd be looking at a construction year of 2024 on this. And, you know, I always give dates like that a little bit of a caveat because things can move up or back in the program just based on a number of different things. But again, the Pell study is hyper-focused on public involvement. So we really want to make sure that at every step along the way, so we're in the early stages now, but we want that public input throughout the process. So this is the first round of public information meetings. There will be more. So certainly, you know, watch that website that I mentioned, IndianaFlexRoad.com, and then also our social media outlets here at NDOT Northwest, Facebook.com/NDOTNorthwest and at NDOT Northwest on Twitter. We'll have plenty of information on there as this study plays out over the coming years.
Anna Parkhouse is the communications director for the LaPorte District of NDOT, based, of course, in LaPorte, but covers Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties and other counties here in northwest Indiana. And talking in this case about the 8094 Flex Road project, the first and now a study of and public input as well coming up this week in finding ways to make I-8094 as safe as possible and certainly make the travel a lot smoother for people and trucks as well as vehicles to be able to traverse that road, a very, very extremely busy road, as you've heard. And Adam, thank you for being with us to talk about this. Once again, the public meetings are coming up on July 28th, and it'll be held, both of them actually, at 5 p.m., and the first one on the 28th will be held at the 21st Century Charter School in Gary, and the 29th meeting at 5 p.m. will be at Alumni Hall on the Purdue University Northwest campus in Hammond. And Adam, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Parenting Institute is alive and doing very well. In fact, they're about to do a relaunch, I guess you could call it that. Let's talk with the founder and executive director of the IPI, Laura Wynn. And Laura, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you very much for inviting us to be a part of this. I'm very excited. We have a lot of stuff to let on over here.
Before we started talking here, you mentioned that there are a lot of things to bring up. Let's first mention, I guess, the major reason for the IPI's relaunch, which is happening soon, I understand.
Yes, absolutely. I would say by the middle of August, everything should be out in the open, and everybody will see and know exactly what it is that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing that not because anything awful has happened. It's just because of COVID, actually. Just like a lot of organizations and a lot of businesses across the world actually went through that whole process of having to kind of downsize in many ways and in many ways just kind of rethinking how you want to move forward. Well, we have a new board of directors and they have rethought our processes and rethought how we should now reintroduce ourselves to the community in a very positive way. We will continue to serve families. That is exactly what we do, and that's what we will always do, provide parenting education and support services. But we will be expanding our outreach in terms of the services that we provide to include also classes for people who are interested in becoming paraprofessionals as parent educators, because there's definitely a need in the marketplace for that. And then some other things coming along.
I was wondering if that might be the case, that because of the pandemic, so many people have had to take on different roles, much more beyond just being a parent, a father or a mother, or a caregiver of some type for a family member, that we had to kind of rethink how the IPI, the Indiana Parenting Institute, really works.
Absolutely. And it's kind of an interesting situation, because out of this, what could be considered a very negative situation that happened to us, there's a lot of positives coming out of it. And I don't think that applies only to Indiana Parenting Institute, but I think it applies to a lot of organizations. We learned a lot about the importance of technology in terms of communicating with people, in terms of just conducting our business from day to day. Because all during COVID, we were open. I mean, we were shut down for a little while, but we continued to do our business. And so we discovered a lot of ways that business could be conducted. And those are the things that we will be bringing to the community. So we're very excited about it.
One of the things that I mentioned in the constant comment, constant contact information that a lot of people have got about the Indiana Parenting Institute talks about the offering of individual, virtual, and group parenting for people raising preteens. And this must be one of the new developments that the IPI has taken on now.
Absolutely, because what we've discovered through COVID is that a lot of parents were really stressed out about what to do with their kids during this period. And it's an area that we kind of sort of did, but we never had a real direct focus on it, because we were working with parents with children birth to 18. And so as we continued to work with parents during COVID, we discovered that a lot of them, with kids being home, that they were really struggling with what do I do with my kid? They're getting on my nerve and I don't exactly know how to deal with it. And so they would reach out to us. And of course, we would come to their rescue. We would work with them and provide them with solutions in terms of how to handle all that. And so it just turned out to be a very interesting an interesting experience for us and the parents, and they were very grateful for it. The kids were better. So we've decided to do some life skills, and we think that parents and youth will benefit from that kind of a program. So we're very excited about it.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation about the IPI making some changes that will take effect sometime in the month of August. And, and some of the changes, of course, you mentioned are coming, I guess, from the new board of directors.
Yeah, we have a new board. I'm pretty excited.
Did they do a serious rethinking because of either new members or just the fact that they realized the pandemic has changed everything so dramatically?
Well, they realized that we had not reached our full potential. And so their goal is, let's reach our highest level of potential. And that's what they are doing. And they are feet on the ground and hands on. So we're very happy about that as well. So we're relaunching to adequately address the needs of 21st century families. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to the new processes that are coming by, the new people that have come on board in the office, our staff, just excited. I mean, there are new things. We have a new COO, as I mentioned, and we're looking to become more engaged in the community. So, yeah, it's all good. There's nothing unpleasant about what's moving forward for us.
Now, have the changes also included anything that people may want to rely on for contact or for advice or information about the Indiana Parenting Institute? Can they reach you at the usual web address, for example?
Yes, you can continue to reach us at www.indianaparentinginstitute.org. And our telephone number has not changed. It's 219-886-1111. That's 219-886-1111. And we have both online classes, virtual classes, for people who are interested in having parenting help online, and we can do both individual and group. We also have in-house classes for people who like the in-class experience here at Indiana Parenting Institute. Standing here now looking in our classroom, like, where are my parents?
They'll be there soon.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, because we're getting back to business.
Laura Wynn is the executive director of the Indiana Parenting Institute. They're still located in Gary, and you still reach them by calling 219-886-1111. And Laura, thank you very much for the latest information, and looking forward to more and bigger developments coming from the IPI very soon.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say we are in the Centaur Bank building right on 5th and Broadway in Gary. I appreciate you very much, Chris. Thank you so much for inviting us.
You're entirely welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A former University of Notre Dame student has filed a lawsuit against the school seeking a refund on tuition and fees for the spring 2020 semester after classes were moved online because of the pandemic. Recent graduate Evan Slattery filed the lawsuit in federal court, and he's seeking prorated refunds for the spring semester's tuition, more than $27,000, as well as more than $250 in mandatory student fees. Slattery's lawsuit argues that students pay tuition for an in-person learning experience, and the shift to online classes did not provide the same level of value. And he alleges the university did not reimburse any of this mandatory fees, which went to facilities or services that students no longer had access to, such as the Student Health Center. The semester ran from January to June 2020, but University of Notre Dame moved all classes online in mid-March because of COVID-19. The lawsuit was filed as a class action, which means that any student who attended the University of Notre Dame during the spring 2020 semester can join. Notre Dame did reimburse students a prorated amount for the spring semester's room and board fees last year. Indiana State Fair returns on July 30th, 1 year after it was canceled for the first time since World War II. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on what's a little different about this year's fair.
State Fair Director of Communications Sharon Smith says there will not be any COVID-19 restrictions imposed on guests at this year's fair.
We do ask that folks who are not fully vaccinated definitely follow the guidelines, the CDC guidelines requiring whether and when they should wear a face covering.
There are some changes, however. To spread out attendance, the fair added a weekend onto its normal schedule. And Smith, appearing on the statewide talk show All In, says the fair will be closed Mondays and Tuesdays.
And that kind of allows us to refresh programming on those down days to refresh the campus.
The State Fair in Indianapolis runs July 30th through August 22nd. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with me in studio is the creator and the producer and the host of the fella whose music you hear, we just heard a snippet of, every single weekend on Sundays with Shep. Ryan Preece is with us in the studio to talk about a very special celebration this year. In fact, today, as a matter of fact.
It is today, yeah. I don't know if it's a big celebration. I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been more mentioned about it, but today would mark the 100th anniversary of Gene Shepherd's birth.
That's right.
July 26, 1921, in Chicago. He was not born in Indiana. He actually lived in Chicago for the first 6 years of his life, and then his family moved to East Chicago. And then when he was about seven, they moved to Hammond, which is where most of the stories surrounding Gene Shepherd's childhood take place.
So he went to basically, I guess if he'd gone to kindergarten, he would have gone to kindergarten at some school over in Chicago before the family moved over to the neighborhood?
Right, yeah. And he has made mention of at least his East Chicago time in a couple of programs. But most of the programs that we know and the stories that we know revolve around his time at Warren G. Harding Elementary School in Hammond.
Mm-hmm. And we know that he was one to like to embellish on the truth. Mm-hmm. I guess that's how he got his reputation over the years. Maybe he didn't start that way when he was on Northwest Indiana Radio, when he worked for Hammond radio station WJOB. He was probably doing it pretty even keel then. But later, as he went on to bigger and better places, including when he finally ended up at WOR Radio in New York City, he was ready to take on a story and just stretch it out to the most, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. and a lot of the experiences are based in truth, and he did embellish, but I was looking through some of the, in preparation for this program, looking at some of the characters that he mentioned, and a lot of the family members that he mentioned are actual family members. A lot of the teachers that he mentions from Warren G. Harding Elementary School and Hammond High School, if you look them up in the yearbook, they're actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his friends, there was a Flick, there was a Jack Flickinger, there was a Bolus Rutkowski, and you know there was a Gasser that you know, we can go back and look at. So some of the characters' names, especially like from his Army days, are names that he made up. But while he did stretch the truth a little bit, a lot of it is based in reality and his actual experiences growing up in Northwest Indiana.
Let's talk about what he did when he finally graduated from high school in Hammond. You say, of course, he went into the Army. Was that right out of high school?
He went into the Army in 1942. He enlisted, and he was in the Signal Corps. He never left the United States during World War II. He did a lot of Signal Corps work in Missouri. Some of the radar work he did that he talks about is down in the Florida Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
And he one of the recent shows that we aired talks about his time down in the Florida Everglades with a radar unit that was looking for German U-boats that may be somewhere off the Florida coast, and you know what they would actually do if they actually happened. A radar blip came up that it actually was a U-boat. So that was his experience in the Army Signal Corps. He was discharged in 1944, and then he came back to Northwest Indiana. He worked at WJOB in Hammond for a little while, and then started to branch out a little bit, going to he worked in Toledo for a little while in radio, and then went to Cincinnati, Philadelphia, then back to Cincinnati, and then went to New York, and actually went to New York to get a television job. He was considered to be one of the successors to host The Tonight Show when Steve Allen left The Tonight Show. And he was, NBC thought that Jack Parr, who was, they had to offer the contract to, would turn down the job because he was going to look for a primetime show. Well, Jack Parr actually did take the job to succeed Steve Allen as the host of The Tonight Show, and Gene Shepard ended up working in radio, doing a little bit of television work, but radio was not the job that Shep went to New York to seek.
Hmm. And we should mention, and we'll find out more, I'm sure, Nick Mattis is working on a documentary film about Gene Shepard, his life locally as well as elsewhere. He's talked to a lot of people, and he is with us on the phone right now. Nick, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today. We'll get into more detail about this, but if you will first give us an idea of some of the people, some of the places you've checked out as you've had a chance to film various places, talk to a number of people for the film that you're putting together in the documentary.
All right, before I do that, let me just pick up where Ryan left off, and that's allegedly went to New York for a television career. As much as we want to say that he embellished his stories of childhood, his career is somewhat also embellished to some degree. So there's all kinds of theories out there, but we'll run with that. I mean, I'll give Steph the benefit of the doubt.
Well, that's good, but, you know. Yeah.
But, okay, to put a bear hug around Gene Shepard has been very difficult to do because he wasn't just an actor or a radio host or a writer. He was all of those. And so he had four or five different careers to try and do a documentary around. So basically what I did was I started off here in the region, and I was able to get some interviews with people that knew and grew up with him here. And their testimonials about Gene Shepard are vastly different from those that I interviewed out in the New York and Cincinnati areas. But I did follow his career chronologically to some degree. The Cincinnati guys were, they remembered Gene Shepard and how they say out there that he polished his radio skills in Cincinnati before he went out to New York. And to some degree, they're correct in that, in terms of his monologues and his humor and his story-building technique. He did a very good job there. And so then I followed the New York folks there, and I was able to interview one of his producers and engineer, a married couple that worked with Shep and Lee Brown towards the end of his career. Well, at least, you know, the last, like, 8 years of his career. And that was interesting as well. And for me, to be interviewing these people that worked with Gene Shepard, it was a surreal moment there, to be sitting face-to-face with people that actually worked with one of America's greatest storytellers. And then, you know, the reason the documentary is to show the expansive reach that Gene Shepard had in the medium. And one of them was to influence people such as Jerry Seinfeld, who, you know, grew up reading Gene Shepard articles. And, you know, there you go, his writing career. And some of the magazines, car magazines that Jerry read as a teenager growing up in Massapequa, New York. And so we spoke in Chicago. We interviewed. We met originally at the Night of Remembering Gene Shepard at the Paley Center. And then he followed up and was true to his word to let me do an interview with him in Chicago a couple years ago. And we had it off really good. He was very much influenced by Gene Shepard. But, you know, I saw Ryan, I just heard Ryan kind of mention something about there wasn't too much celebratory around Gene Shepard's centennial birthday. And that's the point of the documentary, because so many people just think all he did was a Christmas story. Mm-hmm. And the guy did so much more than that. And, you know, he had his hand in everything. I mean, from flash mobs to fundraising to being quoted in iconic movies such as Network, to songs, country songs. It's incredible. He got to hang out with the Beatles before they became the Beatles. And he took a realistic approach on everything. You know, he said a writer has to have an editor's eye. And for the most part, he had that down, his skill honed perfectly for that. He just cut everything right down the middle. Didn't put too much of his opinion in his writing. He just wanted people to celebrate what he saw as America, whether it was people there, as one of the people I interviewed who played Flick in the PBS movies mentioned that it was the rituals, the everyday rituals of individuals and groups, and he played on that very well.
Now, Ryan, you mentioned in some of the comments that you make in the programs and Sundays with Shep, the latest ones here, you mentioned it come from a lot of his performances that he didn't do on the radio, but he did do in New York City. Tell us about those live performances that we get the chance to hear these days.
Well, they were on the radio, but, you know, you look at Shep's schedule, as he worked 6 days a week a lot of times in the 1960s. He did an hour show, or a 45-minute show, Monday through Friday on WOR. And then on Saturday nights, he would go to the Limelight Cafe in Greenwich Village and perform in front of a live audience there for 2 hours. And that was also aired on WOR. And he was he had a little bit more free form there in those Limelight shows, and it was interesting to hear the audience reaction. But, you know, Shep, for what I think makes his show so timeless and some of his broadcasts so timeless is that he doesn't follow the formula of what we think of talk radio today. It was basically 45 minutes of Shep talking. He didn't have any guests. He didn't take any calls. He just talked, and he would sometimes meander. He'd start with a story. He'd start with a line, and then he'd meander off into a couple other things, and, you know, is he going to get to the end of the story? And then as the music's queuing up to end the show, he brings it full circle and, you know, brings that story back.
Uh-huh. I know that you can tell the way that he has weaving his thoughts into all of the programs, and even the more structured ones that are just simply on the radio, that is, in the studio on the radio, I should say. You can always tell that he gets out there, he goes on something, and he stays with it for a long time, but he always manages to come back to the major theme, probably right before the show ends.
Right. And I don't think he ever talked above his audience. He was kind of a Renaissance man. You know, he's a guy who loved cars, he loved travel, and, you know, he would talk about all of these things, but always put it on the level of his listener. He would never think that he was better than the people that were listening to his program.
Now, Nick, if you will, we're getting close to wrapping up conversation here. Mentioned the fact that I guess celebrating the 100th anniversary of Gene Shepard's birth is not one of those red letter days, but I'm certainly sure that you are going to celebrate him, at least as long as you're still working on the documentary, huh?
Yeah, I'm actually working on it right now. And, you know, I might even, now that you mentioned it, I might even run over to Hespel and have a beer at Flicks over there. I think it'll open a little bit. Well, the new Flicks down the street from the original Flicks. But yeah, Shep, I'll have a cheeseburger and a beer for him at some point today. Listening to all his radio shows, as Ryan does, he's, you know, illuminated my mind, the way I see things. I didn't know anything about Gene Shepard when I first started this. and now I hear him echoing through my brain. I have a giant picture of him over to my left shoulder here. I'm looking at right now of him. And, you know, the guy did so much more. And for us not to recognize his skills in storytelling and how he so much benefited the listener every evening in those days in Cincinnati, New York, and even on PBS and A Christmas Story. He's been able to give so much to people. And he does deserve some sort of recognition for that.
Well, Nick Mattis, thank you for being with us. Nick Mattis is a documentary filmmaker, and Ryan Priest is the creator and the producer and host of Sundays with Shep that you get to hear here on Lakeshore Public Radio, as well as the podcast, too. They're on our website as well. And gentlemen, both thank you very much for being with us today.
Excelsior.
It's my birthday!
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the organization called Women for Change have another public forum coming up this week, and we'll talk with one of the panelists, State Representative Carolyn Jackson of Hammond, about it, and we hope you can join us for that conversation.